Welcome to the Edu All-Stars Podcast.
Hey guys, and welcome to the 71st episode of Edu All-Stars. My name is Todd Nesloni, and you can find me on Twitter at TechNinjaTodd. My co-host, Chris Kessler, is not here yet. He is having some Wi-Fi issues, and hopefully we'll be bopping on here in just a minute. But we're going to go ahead and get started and have him join. We want to just welcome everybody back to the podcast and thank you for all the reviews and comments that you've left on iTunes and on Twitter. As you listen to this week's episode, we encourage you to tweet out using the EduAllStars hashtag. We love seeing the conversations and hearing about the things that stick out to you. This week's guest is Rushton Hurley. He has been a Japanese language teacher, a principal of an online high school, teacher trainer, educational technology researcher, and even a school reform consultant. So thank you, Rushton, for coming on with us today.
Hey, pleasure to be here.
Well, the best place we always like to start with our guests is hearing a little bit about your background and your journey into education.
Sure. So, born in the late 60s, child of the 60s, all right. And early on, my family moved to Singapore. And so I had this kind of international school experience. And that planted a lot of kind of important seeds for me, right? Then went to public high school in Arkansas, went to college in San Antonio, Texas, a small private liberal arts school called Trinity University, great place. Then went to Japan, taught in high schools and junior highs in the Goto Islands, which are 4 hours by the big slow boat west of Nagasaki. I was an assistant language teacher, so I was working alongside Japanese teachers of English. That was actually where I figured out I really like working with teenagers. I mean, just what an interesting crowd, you know, this quirky bunch is, you know, that kind of stuff. Then spent a year in Australia doing kind of some more stuff, and then ultimately got back to the States and to California, where I went to Stanford for graduate degrees, one in East Asian Studies and one in Education, and that's how I got my credential. And began teaching high school full-time as a Japanese language teacher at Silver Creek High School on Eastside San Jose. I spent almost a decade doing that. My wife and I moved to Texas. I became principal of an online high school. I was part of a pilot program that was going on in 2001, 2003. Interesting experience, right? And then when we moved back to California, I started a nonprofit called Next Vista for Learning, which I will talk about ad nauseum if given the chance. And with that, I now travel all over the world speaking to people about, you know, kind of possibilities with free technologies and digital media and kind of how to get the best out of your students, how to kind of connect with your colleagues around the world, how to save yourselves time. Yeah, I mean, stuff like that. So, I kind of see myself as an educational motivational speaker, really, in a sense, you know, I mean. But the bottom line is it's a whole lot of fun, and I seem to be helping some folks, and so as long as I can keep doing that, great. And if I'm not doing that anymore, I'll go back to teaching, and I love that, and all good.
So talk to me a little bit more about the Japanese language teacher. I find that so interesting. I would never think about teaching Japanese or working with students who are Japanese. What was that like? I mean, what did you learn from that experience, and how did that even all work out?
Now, are we talking about my experience in Japan teaching Japanese teens, or my experience in the United States teaching Japanese language to Americans?
Let's start with in Japan first, and then come back to the United States.
Yeah, okay, so it's a program called the Japan Exchange Teaching Program, and it's Japan's way of kind of internationalizing the populace, in a sense, bring natives from other countries in, and make sure that the kids get to meet people and, you know, get a sense of, okay, what another part of the world is like. It's a good program. I applied to it because I'd spent a semester in Japan, and I knew about it and thought, okay, well, I mean, that'd be a cool option. And as I got turned down for everything else that I applied for as a senior in college, it was nothing but happiness that one came through. And that totally shaped, you know, my professional, you know, kind of path as well. So, you know, I mean, if you get turned down by, you know, 20 different things and the 21st comes through, awesome.
So working with those students, I mean, you've worked with a lot of American students. What were some of the biggest differences you noticed between those students and American students?
The Japanese, well, you know, I mean, What the Japanese students would do in terms of like conforming to a stereotype we have very much depended on which you know, which school I was working with. You know, so some schools were these kind of highly academic schools where kids, you know, were kind of studying their posteriors off and, you know, like, you know, kind of trying for everything. Others were like, yeah, whatever, English. Yeah, I don't get it. I mean, there are such schools in Japan. Aren't the ones you typically hear about. I mean, for kind of obvious reasons, right? But nevertheless, you know, the thing about it was is that like anywhere, right? They're just kids, right? And they want to feel like you know, they belong in kind of their environment. They want to feel like they're, you know, they're doing something cool, becoming people who are cool in some way. You know, get a sense of, you know, what they can give, really. You know, I mean, I think every kid at core, consciously or unconsciously, wants to know that he or she has something to give. And you know, I was working with some of these kids at one point. I remember this one kid. We had an English speaking club. The Westerner was recruited as part of the team that, you know, worked with the English speaking club. And so there was this one kid in the club who was kind of like, I guess to say he was kind of like a nerd off the scale. But you know, I mean, tried hard and everything like that. And you know, kind of good enough kid, you know, and we would often like try a little too hard, you know. But the one thing about him is he had kind of a messed up tooth. All right. Now, about halfway through the school year, I'd been visiting another couple of schools. I come back, you know, and I see him for the first time in that little stretch, and he'd had the tooth repaired. And, you know, I said, hey, you know, your teeth look really good. And I should say his English was pretty good, all right, in part because he tried hard all the time, right? You know, Google was filled with these people. But he looked at me and said, thank you. I've had it fixed for a week, and you're the first person to say anything.
Oh, wow.
Well, exactly. And it was one of those moments where I thought, oh, really? You know, but on the other hand, you know, what a reminder. What a reminder to me and to anyone, right, that the little things that we say mean so much to these kids. You know, they cop a tough attitude. They're quirky. They're nerdy. They're whatever they are, right? And yet, someone just stopping and saying something kind to them is everything, right? And that sense that you have the power to do so much good was something that I think made me stop and think, oh man, I like this. I like this a lot, right?
Right.
And so anyway, so, you know, had more moments like that, and, you know, got into teaching here, and, you know, soon found out that, you know, if you're paying any attention at all, those moments just happen and happen and happen and happen.
So did you speak any Japanese before you went over there?
So when I went over there as a junior, I went over there for a semester my junior year, fall of 87, 80s music, baby, awesome. and I didn't speak, you know, anything. Right at that point, and it threw us into this kind of program. I wasn't even thinking about learning the language, because I was really there because I was a history major. I was really into Asian history, and you know, I was like, yeah, language, sure, whatever. And I get into that first class where they launch us into learning it, and we just started learning at light speed. I mean, like, just the things that they had us doing, it was like, what, you know? So our heads were spinning, you know, coming out, and I thought, wow. So part of it for me with the language program there was that I really could tell, I could see my progress. And that's one of the things about teaching a language. You know, if you're going fast enough, and not everybody does, right, no matter the language, if you're going fast enough, the kids are very much aware of the progress they're making, which and that's motivating to them. So, you know, I was kind of like, wow, you know, this is awesome. And, of course, I was there, so I could go out and I could try it out. I just kind of learned that, you know, if I took whatever I was learning and inflicted it upon people and smiled a lot, you know, I mean, things kind of worked out. So, yeah, it was such a blast. I mean, it was kind of the first thing I ever studied where I thought, you know, that's just ridiculously cool. It's going to take years for me to get anywhere with this, but I think I want to do that, you know, and that continued. I mean, to this day, you know, I mean, I still, you know, kind of, even though I'm not doing anything with Japanese professionally at the moment, you know, I still like study the characters and stuff. You know, just kind of all my time. I got an app on my iPod, you know, that kind of thing. Where I'm just kind of checking it out.
So I love that part of what you've done too is that you've been a principal, but a principal of an online high school.
Yeah.
So what was that experience like? I mean, how are you? What does that even look like?
So all right, you know, let's go back 12 years and imagine what was on the internet at the time, right? Very different scenario than today. But I'll tell you, the novelty didn't stop at it being online. I was also working with a specialized system that was a self-paced curriculum. So, you know, we weren't even, you know, calendar driven, right? You know, so the whole idea was to get kids in, to identify what their needs were, and then to try to get them to their gaps. And this kind of the best place to explain this is math, right? Imagine what we do with a kid who's having trouble in algebra one. You know, they get so far into the semester or the second semester or whatever, and then they have trouble and they don't ask for help, and then it kind of all falls apart. And so what do? We make them repeat the grade. So they come back the next year, you know, they start studying. Well, actually, they don't, because it comes so easy that they don't need to study. They're like, oh, this rocks. This is so easy. They get to that point that they had trouble with the year before. They're not even used to studying at that point, right? So they hit the same barrier, and with it, unless somebody has trained them to go, ooh, I'm having trouble now. They told me that this was coming, which they never do. Then you know, they just kind of have the same thing happen. Well, it looks like I have to repeat again. You know, I mean, how depressing is that? In fact, what we need is just to be able to say, okay, we need to know where the gap is. Okay, well, it's this. Got it. Okay, well, let's sit down and work with this for, you know, an hour, a week, whatever it takes. And once you're past that gap, bam, you can start going again. And so that was kind of our thing, you know. They'd work with stuff online. They'd communicate with the teachers, you know, as needed, and then they'd come in and test with us, right? Because the boundaries of our school program was Bexar County, like the county that includes San Antonio. That's where we were. And so they could come in. And they'd come in for science labs as well, you know, that kind of thing. But when they'd come in for the test, because it was self-paced, right, I mean, we could just kind of sit down with them. So, you know, imagine a kid coming in for a U.S. history test. All right, I'm ready to take my test on, you know, second half of the 19th century, whatever it is. So, okay, all good. Before you do, I just want to ask a question or two. Why don't you tell me about Reconstruction? You know, and if the kid says, "Oh, well, you know, the South's economy had been devastated by the Civil War, and you know, their whole labor base, you know, blah blah blah," you know, and you're like, "Okay, no problem. Okay, here's the test. Go ahead." But if the kid's like, "Reconstruction, they built it again," you know, and you're like, "You don't know. I mean, dude, you can't take this test. You know, don't come in here to take a test just because you think you might pass it. Know the material." So the whole thing about our system was that it really got kids honest with themselves about what they didn't know and whether they were or weren't prepared, right? So, I mean, and that's a system that doesn't need to be online by any stretch, but ours just happened to be. So we ended up with all these kids who had, like, medical conditions, or they were, like, taking care of somebody at home, or they were the breadwinners for the family, or they had their own children. You know, I mean, sometimes, you know, people look at schools of choice, you know, like charters and other schools like that, and they're like, oh, they're going to take the cream of the crop. And it's like, forget that. The cream of the crop are very happy where they are because they're successful, right? You know, the people that were coming into our program, they kind of, you know, the mom would show up, and we'd start to explain the philosophy of, like, the self-paced curriculum. And they're like, will you take my boy? Yeah. Where do I sign? Right? You know, these kids were like, hey, my talent is giving the finger to the system as it is, you know. You're like, yeah, great, you know. So, you know, we bring them in and try to get them to where they're like, oh, okay, wait, I can do this. I can do it different, and that's what I needed, was different. So all of that rambling to say that it was a great experience. I mean, you know, it was wonderful to try different things out, to kind of work with a team. I mean, you're constantly working with other adults as well, right, talking about how do we make this work for this kid? How do we make this work? It was cool. It was a great experience.
Well, and now you've got the Next Vista for Learning. What's that about?
That is my little attempt to save the world from ignorance right there. All right, one creative video at a time. Next Vista for Learning is an online library of videos. They're made by and for teachers and students everywhere, free to use, free to contribute to, free to download from. You know, you're like, well, what about it isn't free? Nothing. It's all free. This is my little attempt to make the world a better place. It's like, well, you got to have revenue. That's true. What I do as a speaker and a trainer, I invoice from the nonprofit, and that's the revenue that runs you know, my little charity, and life's good. So it all works out. I mean, I'm not becoming a bazillionaire, but that wasn't really the point. It's a chance to highlight creative approaches to learning something. Teachers, you know, send us videos. Kids send us videos. We do a number of things to try to get, you know, people to share videos with us. One is that we run contests. We run three contests a year. Maybe in the liner notes or something we can add a link to our current contest. You know, if you go to nextvista.org and you click on the flaming bird on the front of the on the homepage. It's actually Phoenix. All right, and you know, that'll take you to our Creative Fire video contest, which is going on at the moment. But it kind of comes down to this: in 90 seconds or less, creatively explain something one might encounter in school. And we've gotten all kinds of cool videos as a result of this. I mean, you know, I mean, kids put together some brilliant pieces, some lame ones as well. I mean, sure. But what we do, though, is we give feedback, right? So they send the video in. We write back, okay, well, you know, this part didn't make any sense at all to us, and you've got music, but no credit for it, and, you know, you've got some pictures, but they're copyrighted, and you'll need to look at the rules again, because they tell you exactly which sites you can use, and we'd love to have this video. We just need a few fixes. Can you do it? And more often than not, they do, and they know that they've done something good, right? Because that happens for a lot of kids. You know, our teacher says, I'd like you to make a video, and so they make a video, and it's like, here's a video, and the teacher's like, great, it's a video, and we all move on with our lives. It's like, did it help the learning or not, right? And so, you know, that's what we want, is we want kids to be like, it's good. It is good, right? I know it's good because six people helped me go from lame to good, you know, or whatever, right? And so that's a big part. We do some other contests, too. We do a service contest every year that near and dear to my heart, which is getting kids to get to know charities in their community and to tell their stories by interviewing a volunteer and getting some visuals and you know, they're, you know, charities are these kind of overworked, understaffed, underfunded entities that, you know, can barely get it together to explain to the community, you know, what they do, right? And so if some kids go in and say, we want to make a video telling, you know, who you are and why you're great or whatever, you know, that's awesome. So what we did, like this last spring, for example, we said, okay, the top 10 videos will get $200 donations to the charities that you highlight in the videos. And, you know, that seemed to really help. A lot of people were like, hey, let's give that a shot. And you know, the 10 that, you know, that were the finalists, four of them were named winners, and the kids that made that, the teams got $50 gift cards, you know, because, you know, we certificates, international glory, things like that. So
that's,
you know,
awesome.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that we always like to ask our guests is what are you reading right now? Whether it's a book that has nothing to do with education, or if it is an educational book, what is something that you're reading right now or have just read?
Sure. All right. So I'm gonna broaden that word read there a little. That's all right.
That's fine.
Because when I sit down to read, I'm usually like playing Sudoku or 2048 or something like that. 2048 just recently, man, 69,700.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, I'm still obnoxious to be around as a result of this. anyway. So what I am really into is lectures, right? And I know that in our world we poo-poo lectures, like, oh, don't lecture, you know. But the truth is not that lecturing is bad. It's that 99 out of 100 people who lecture do it poorly. Mm-hmm. Right? And so there's a company called The Teaching Company. And what they do is they find professors who've won awards for their teaching. Right? And then they kind of winnow it down from there. And so you end up with these professors giving these half-hour lectures. The courses are like 24 of these lectures, or 36 or 48 or whatever. And they're just ridiculously interesting. Right? I mean, it's like the best college teacher you had, a whole set of them in one company, right? And the normal prices that they offer are kind of laughably expensive. You're like, you know, who would pay that? You know, I don't know. Somebody who doesn't look at price tags. But every course goes on sale. I mean, I sound like a commercial to these people. Every course goes on sale at least once a year. And the download price is like $35 for a 24-lecture course. Mm-hmm. So that explains why I'm broadening the term reading for you, right?
Yeah.
So what I'm listening to at the moment, one is a series on African history. really sub-Saharan African history, done by this dude who's just kind of endlessly interesting. You know, one of those people who starts talking, you're like, ooh, what does he have to say? Mm-hmm. So that's one of the ones that I'm listening to. Finished one just recently on London's history, which really liked. And just started another one, just so I can kind of switch back and forth and not listen to the same thing all the time, called Cycles of American Political Thought. And that's kind of cool to me. So, I mean, I really like kind of the history, philosophy, that kind of stuff. Right. And just I find it fun. So, some people spend money on skiing, others on clothes. I spend money on lectures.
That's awesome. Well, when you are having a really rough day, what is something that you like to do to recenter yourself besides listen to lectures?
All right. Well, so several things. James Taylor music. It's a good move, right? Actually, music of almost any sort. I'm a major music guy. Back in the day, played trombone.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The operative piece of that last sentence, back in the day. I just getting out for a walk is good, too. What's the downside of living in Northern California? It's ridiculously expensive. What's the upside? Perfect weather almost all the time. So I'm like 35 minutes from the coast. Go down to Santa Cruz and walk along, Westcliff Drive and look out over the ocean, with my beloved wife. Not that I have other wives, and only one's beloved. I mean, I have one wife, she's beloved. I like doing that. Petting the cat's a good move, because my wife and I don't have children by choice. I mean, children are great for people who want to have children, who are ready to have children. She and I were like, we can do without, right? And so, come home at the end of the day, no children, cat ready to purr when you pet it, life's good. So we like dote on our nieces and nephews and friends' children, and then when they get annoying, we just send them home with kids, with parents. So being around the cat's good. I travel a lot as a result of kind of the work I do, which means I regularly have the chance to see cool places, to meet kind of these interesting teachers doing cool things. I mean, that's seriously energizing. You can be having a bad day, like, oh, this person has done this thing that has helped these kids, kind of totally turn around, from a juvenile hall program, whatever it is, There's so many cool people out there doing cool things, and we often just don't know.
Well, what's been the biggest thing that you think you've learned in the last year?
Well, that kind of falls into the ridiculously cool question category right there. So I think, and this has actually worked its way into a lot of my speaking as well. One of the things that I've kind of zeroed in on, I mean, like anything else, it's stuff we all kind of know, but then you find like a particular way to express it, and that seems to work for people. So I've really focused in on the problems associated with asking for right answers, right? So this is something we all do as teachers. Who knows the right answer? Well, what happens when we ask for the right answer? Most of the room defers to the three or four kids who always get the right answer. I don't think that's what we're trying to do is to validate the living daylights out of three or four kids while the rest of the kids watch, right? Finding ways to actually move the questions into this kind of open-ended creative space where what the students do is really begin to build off of each other's ideas and get impressed with each other, kind of like, wow, that guy hadn't spoken in like 6 months, and that was awesome. Those are good moments, right? So I feel like that channel on the stuff I've been doing is something that has strummed a lot of chords out there, I guess, where people are that's what I want. Is I want the kind of things that I talk about with regard to technology to be valuable way beyond training how to use Google Drive or something, right? I want it to be that which moves a teacher from being someone who's kind of about technology to I love exploring, right? That's what I want. Is I want to kind of bring the inner explorer out of every teacher, and the way to do it, I think, is to get people talking with each other about something for which we're all kind of on a level playing field. right? Because no one knows everything about educational technology. If you do, then 5 minutes from now, you'll be behind the way it is, right? So consequently, if you can get people to stop and go, okay, yeah, here's what I learned. What do you think of it? And even if you don't know a squat about technology, you can ask good questions, which is kind of the point. So I would say, I would say that kind of realization about the nature of creativity and exploration as opposed to trying to identify right answers is probably the coolest piece of the last year for me.
Well, I guess that kind of leads into my last question. I don't know if that already answers it or not yet, but what is something right now that you're really passionate about?
You know, service, Rotary. Let me kind of plug a thing I could go on for reasons that I think will be good for the listeners, right? So most of the audience will have heard of Rotary. So Rotary International is a service organization, been around for over a century, but people think about it and they think, okay, well that's like those business leaders who get together for lunch once a week, right? And the answer is yes, sort of, right? That's traditionally what it was. But it's expanded over time, and one of the things that's been the case for the last decade is that there are online Rotary clubs. So suddenly, something that a teacher would have never considered joining, because it's like, they meet for lunch or breakfast, I can't do that. Suddenly, it's like, oh, I could do that at any time. And teachers know more about kind of what kids need and consequently the community needs than most other professions, right? So I've been a Rotarian for a decade, and about 6 years ago I joined an online club because of some work changes, and just found that one of the things I really love about it is that it's my chance to explore how technology can serve service, and that's really interesting to me. I am working with a team here in Northern California to start the Rotary E-Club of the Silicon Valley. And once we've got it set up and chartered, we're gonna, I'll be moving kind of my membership from my current club to that club. The club I'm in now, by the way, good club, called the Rotary E-Club of the Southwest USA. It's based out of Phoenix, but it has a global membership, and that's one of the things, right? So it's focused on service to others. You're in touch with people around the world. This one's going to be, particularly fun as, kind of the one with the name Silicon Valley. I mean, the expectations are high, right? And I'm like, fucking on, man, that's awesome. This is what we can explore. This is what we can make an e-club be. And, because we're going to have a heavy, I think teacher presence in the club, all the more of a thing where it's like, this is what we can bring to making the world a better place. So I'm really excited about that. And if anyone listening to this is like, ooh, wait a minute, I've thought for years that would be a cool thing to do, but just never had the time or the work thing you described, is perfect or it identifies me. So being able to do something that's kind of asynchronous and online would be cool. Yeah, I mean, they're very welcome to contact me and we can kind of begin exploring it. So I would say that's something I'm particularly passionate about at the moment.
Well, Rushton, I wanted to thank you so much for coming on the show tonight. How can our listeners connect with you?
The easiest way is to go to nextvista.org. On that page, you'll see in kind of the upper right, it'll say contact us, right? And, you send in something via contact us, it goes directly to me, right? You're looking at the entire full-time employee group of my nonprofit, right? Right here. I'm the lead janitor, all that kind of stuff. So. So, you can contact me that way. I'm very happy to talk with people about, how the different ways of using the videos in the library, because teachers use it in all these videos in all sorts of ways, right? There's about 1,400 videos on the site, so there's kind of, a little something for everybody. If you're interested in our video contest, like that service contest or our 90-second academic video contest, by all means, just send a little note through Contact Us, and I'll get you connected to the right stuff. And we help out as well. That's kind of the nature of the charity, is to help teachers learn to use these kind of tools. If you are kind of curious about that Rotary piece, I mentioned right there at the end, mention that, but all good, all good. That'll get to me. And for my side, I want to say, hey, man, thanks for having me on. 71, prime number, excellent, right? And thanks for the work you guys are doing, and not just to spread, you know, kind of, you know, the word of people who care about this, that, or the other through, you know, through this program, but also, you know, the work you're doing at your school and you know, kind of making something new happen for your community. So I think that's awesome.
Thank you. Well, and for the listeners, the ways you can connect with us are on Twitter at EduAllStarsHQ and using the hashtag EduAllStars. You can also find this podcast as well as the other 70 on EduAllStars.com, or you can search out EduAllStars on iTunes, Podomatic, Stitcher. We've got it up everywhere. We'd also like to encourage everyone to join us next 8 p.m. Central Standard Time, November 9th, as we interview the book whisperer, Donna Lynn Miller. So definitely check that out. Thanks again, Rushton, and thank you, all the viewers. We will see and talk to you again next week.
Oh, good.